Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia.
Dr. Lawyer, idiot chief. For my life is songs of grief with the yellow fear and fearless eyes. He's temper all the times, the times I've tried.
Two Dudes Perspective on Legal Frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer, dude, and a judge.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am still just a dude.
Still dudin'.
Yep. Dude until I die.
You need a t-shirt or a tattoo that says that, dude until I die.
That's right. Hey, I saw something interesting on Facebook today.
Well, that's a first. What is it?
Did you know that ants never get sick?
I did not know that.
You know why?
Why?
Because they have little teeny antibodies.
Okay. I thought this was actually going in the scientific direction.
It is scientific.
The science of bad jokes or puns.
I just thought that was a cute one. You know, you share that one with the kids.
Yeah, I'll definitely share that one with the kids, and they will roll their eyes just as I rolled my eyes. There's one judge in particular at the courthouse that always tells bad jokes every day.
Yeah,
I bet I could probably get him with that one.
I had somebody write in a question on Facebook that wanted to know. Said the lady said her and her husband married like 5 years, and she has tolerated his dad jokes all that time. But surely there's a limit. How long does she have to? And, you know, he said, it's for better or for worse. You've got to tolerate them from now on as long as you're married.
Well, what's the basis for your irreconcilable differences? Well, it's his dad jokes. eventually it could drive you mad, so you might have to break the ties. I don't know.
That's right. Drive you crazy. It's a good humored fun. It was just a bad joke.
It was good, Tommy. I'll give you that.
Oh, good. Thanks.
So you had mentioned last week that you were watching a documentary on Netflix.
Yes. I was scrolling around looking for something to watch, and I saw
there's a lot of stuff to watch out there these days.
Yeah, there is, but there's a lot of bad stuff, too. And I don't mean bad, like, you know, sex and things like that. I just mean it's not very, they're not very good shows. They're not very interesting.
Yeah.
So we have stumbled through several of those. Started watching a series the other night. We watched 3 episodes, said, that's it. We're done. We're not watching this anymore.
Abandon ship.
Yeah. But I did find documentary, which I like documentaries. Mary's not so much on them, but I like them. And it was called Crack. The crack part of it, they're cooking that up all over. That was the secret that got unleashed. And I'd always heard this rumor and about crack, that crack was put into the black communities by the CIA, that they are the ones that made crack prevalent. You know, how do you know whether any of that's true or not? You know, there's a lot of different things going around. There was a series that I started watching a couple years ago called Snowfall, which is based on that. That's the premise of it, is the crack first coming into the black neighborhoods in Los Angeles, and that it was coming from CIA agents.
Oh, the CIA agents were actually boots on the ground helping distribute it.
Yes. They were undercover. They didn't identify themselves as CIA. Right. Now, eventually they had to, sometimes to avoid getting killed, because some of these criminals were a little bit more hesitant to kill a CIA person,
right,
than just John Doe on the street.
Now, Snowfall, that's a fictional show, though, right?
Right. Snowfall's a fictional show based on that. So I had to continue to wonder, is that true? And this documentary kind of answers that question.
Yeah, it talks about the history of cocaine in the United States, just briefly, and then also about how the transition from cocaine to crack came about. And it was actually a very interesting documentary. I agree with you. I watched it all and learned a few things and thought it was pretty interesting. So after talking about that, we thought that might make a good episode because it talks a little bit about the history of crack and cocaine and things like that, and also some of the sentencing guidelines that came out of that and some other legal issues that popped up. So that's the episode today. We're going to talk about coke and not the classic kind.
Coke and crack.
Coke and crack. Yeah, just lay it out there. We're talking about coke and crack.
Coke and so crack.
The documentary, I think it was kind of interesting. It kind of goes through a timeline. It talks about the history of cocaine and whatnot. And it had, of course, Ronald and Nancy Reagan on there. And it had Nancy Reagan doing her famous Just Say No speech on there about how to just say no to drugs. And I remember that from when I was a kid and it was on TV and everywhere. And it had all the different commercials they had. They had Clint Eastwood on there. They had the guy who says he fries an egg in a pan, said, "This is your brain. This is your brain on drugs."
Well, the one that surprised me was Pee Wee Herman.
Yeah. Yeah, Pee Wee Herman was on there too. So it had all these famous people on there who were part of this Just Say No campaign that was taking place. And despite this, it still became a huge problem in the 80s. And this documentary was talking a lot about how it was kind of, the government was actually had this policy of just saying no to drugs on the front, but then in the back, they weren't really doing anything about it because it talked a little bit about the Iran-Contra scandal, wherein the U.S. was selling guns and whatnot to Iran and then taking that money and then putting it into Nicaragua where the rebels are. And then in turn, some of those Nicaraguan rebels were actually selling cocaine that made its way into the United States.
And well, they had to make their money back. They had gone to Congress to try to get support for backing the Contras against the Sandinistas that had taken over the government.
Right.
And Congress said, no, you're not using any U.S. money. So they came up with this plot, basically, where they were going to take missiles and bombs to Iran and get the money for that, then take that and give that to Nicaragua. But see, they had to make the U.S. whole. And the only way they could figure to make the U.S. whole, Nicaragua had plentiful cocaine.
Well,
so
now,
they got the cocaine and brought that back and sold it to these street dealers so that they could then take the cash and replace what they had taken from the U.S. And then everything was kosher.
Now, I don't know that that's actually ever been proven. I think that might be a little bit blurred line between your fictional snowfall and the real truth, because I researched it and I didn't see anything out there that showed that that's actually been proven anywhere.
Well, the CIA may not have smuggled it in or may not have smuggled the majority of it in, but they allowed it to be smuggled in, and they worked with people. They helped set up the routes and the entry points for people working with them to smuggle it in.
Well, again, I don't know that that's true either, because I didn't see anything about that.
Well, that's what it said in the documentary, and that's what I've always heard.
Yeah, but I think there may have been a little bit of a creative license taken with the documentary. Just a little bit. But that makes for good television.
Yeah. But a lot of this was created in a perfect storm because Reagan had set up his whole platform was he was going to make America wealthy. And also, I was shocked to, I didn't remember this part, he used the phrase "make America great again."
Yeah.
That caught me by surprise when he said that.
See, but I think the whole reason that the United States was doing this is the fear of the communist regime in Nicaragua and the Sandinistas. And that they were more, the U.S. was more focused on fighting communism in Central America than they were about the cocaine epidemic that they were helping in part to unleash in the United States. I don't think they actually had any physical action in taking place to the delivery of cocaine or anything like that. That doesn't mean they're not responsible, because they were in fact helping support these people who were producing it and then in turn smuggling it. But I just think that there's not, I mean, and maybe they did, I just don't think it's ever been proven that there was that connection, that the CIA had, you know, boots on the ground taking cocaine to inner cities and things like that. I mean, maybe they did, maybe they didn't. I don't know, but I don't think it's ever been proven.
Well, wasn't there a movie with Tom Cruise in it where he was doing that too? I think it was a movie with Tom Cruise, same type thing. There's, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire, and there's an awful lot of talk going on about all that happening.
Oh, there is, but, you know, unfortunately, we're dealing with fact fact here, so we need to have actual facts that can be verified.
But what had happened, what was really hurting the inner cities at the time, too, was Reagan's policies were making the rich richer and the poor poorer. He had gone through and he had cut 500,000 people off of welfare, 1 million people from food stamps, and 2.6 million children from federal lunch programs. And also at the same time, 8.5 million people were unemployed. And of course, the black community gets hit harder in that statistic than the white communities.
Yeah, absolutely. So it was, like you said, it was kind of the perfect storm of what was taking place. So one of the interesting things is the difference between cocaine and crack. And I actually chemically did not know what the difference is. Cocaine is a hydrochloride salt in its powdered form. Crack cocaine is derived from taking the powdered cocaine, combining it with water and another substance, which is usually baking soda. And what that does is it takes away the salt and it leaves it after being boiled in a solid form. It's then cooled and broken into smaller pieces, and then those smaller pieces are what's sold as crack. And the name crack actually derives from the crackling sound that it makes whenever the drug is heated and then smoked. And it's pretty highly concentrated, and so it makes it pretty addictive. It's not common, but it is possible for a person to become addicted after just one use. So that's the theory.
And I thought it was interesting how basically somebody got the idea to make crack is when Richard Pryor set himself on fire when he was freebasing cocaine.
Yeah.
Which freebasing, a lot of people didn't know what that was. Freebasing is actually doing the same thing as making crack when you freebase it. So what they did is most people didn't have the patience or the materials to go through and do the freebasing part or buy cocaine. So this crack made it so that it was more available to the general public.
Crack really came to light in mainstream America when it affected Lynn Bias. And Lynn Bias was a basketball star, and he was a first-round draft pick by the Boston Celtics out of University of Maryland. And he OD'd and died from crack. And that was what brought it to the front page and the headlines of the United States, really, and ramped up the punishments with the war on drugs and all that. I remember when that happened, actually, back in 86. Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm an old guy now. Like, I remember back when that happened.
Yeah. Yeah, and there was a defensive back in the NFL a week later that died from the same thing. And that those two incidents happening that close together made it seem like, oh, boy, we've got a big problem here.
Yeah, and that is what brought on pretty much the Anti-Drug Abuse Act of 1986, which we'll talk about here in a minute or two. So it's important to understand that there's certain things called sentencing guidelines. And states have sentencing guidelines, at least some of them do. And it basically tells you what someone's going to be sentenced to if they plead guilty or convicted of certain crimes. The most well-known are the federal sentencing guidelines. That's the one that the federal government promulgates. And they're pretty some convoluted, confusing, and whatnot. And the reason that they came to being is in 1984, they felt that there were too many different disparity between how people were getting sentenced, so they wanted to come up with some sort of uniformity so people are sentenced in the same way. So in 1984, the Sentence Reform Act was passed, and it abolished parole and created the U.S. Sentencing Commission, which was to write guidelines for the courts to follow. So if someone's convicted of something, then here's what you sentence them to. Seems like a good idea, right?
Right. That got around some of the judges that they felt were too lenient on drug convictions.
Yeah, or anything. I mean, just kind of it was supposed to make it so it was even for everybody.
Right.
So in 1986, you have the cocaine epidemic, which is really in mainstream America viewed as the crack epidemic, because no one's really talking about cocaine use among the wealthier people, because cocaine is viewed as more of a recreational type thing. It has a certain kind of, I don't know what I'm looking for, romanticism with it. You know, it's like, oh, you know, people, it's kind of, they do it to party on the weekends. It's upper class.
It was rich white people.
Yeah, so it was rich white people.
And so it wasn't considered as bad, whereas crack was considered a drug that black people preferred.
Yeah, lower class, black people, right. Minorities, like, you know. And also taken into consideration with Lynn Bias on the national stage dying, the defensive back for...
I think it was the Browns.
For the Browns, yep, for the Browns that had passed away. So In 1986, the U.S. Sentencing Commission recommended, and the Congress passed the 1986 Anti-Drug Abuse Act, and it had a 100-to-1 disparity between crack and cocaine. Now, basically, they are pretty much the same, as I said above, except crack has its salt removed. So the 100-to-1 ratio in federal sentencing guidelines for crack offenses, crack was punished way more harshly than powder cocaine because there are different fears that went along with it. That crack was more dangerous and addictive to users than cocaine. Not any real study that said this. It was just kind of anecdotal stories and some sort of media sensationalism. There was the whole crack babies epidemic that was supposedly the news put out there. And that was essentially the media's kind of talking point, because if you really want to drive home a story, you talk about kids and babies and things like that. But again, the numbers on that were not actually accurate as to what was being reported at the time either.
Right. They were talking about 60% of kids coming out of these neighborhoods were born addicted to crack and stuff, and the actual percentage was 2-3%.
Yeah, it was way lower. The other thing they said is that crack involved more guns and violence than powdered cocaine trafficking, which, again, it's all the same stuff. It comes from the same place, and it's part of that whole same misconception that cocaine's somewhat socially acceptable, whereas crack, someone who uses that, they're a crackhead or a bad person.
Yeah, that's exactly what they said. It said, first of all, the police in most of these inner city areas were turning their heads to it going on. They knew it was going on, and they would walk right by it and didn't do anything. One was they didn't want to get involved because it was very dangerous. You were dealing with a lot of criminals and gangsters. The other was they didn't care because it was the black community. And they didn't put the value on it. They took the attitude, if they want to kill each other off doing that, let them do it. But the violence that was created, because you had people that were living in abject poverty and suddenly became millionaires overnight selling $5 to $10 crack hits on the streets. They would operate a whole network. And what they started doing is protecting their, say, five blocks. And they were bringing in 15, 16-year-old kids to help them secure their block and sell their drugs. And it was a whole network, a whole hierarchy within there, which eventually led to a lot of guns and then a lot of violence. And when that violence started leaking out into other places, that's when they finally realized they had to do something. But also that they had to first identify the police corruption. Because the police were coming in, they were shaking down drug dealers. It was like, okay, we're going to take your money and your drugs, and what are you going to do about it? You're going to report us to the cops?
Yeah, that's not going to help you much.
Yeah, that one cop, they had him testifying in front of Congress, and he said, yeah, we'd walk in there and just reach in the bag and pull out money and walk off with it. And it's like, what were they going to do about it? And they said, well, didn't some of the good cops, weren't you afraid they'd turn you in? And he said, no, we have the blue wall of silence. Nobody's going to talk.
Do you know what it's called whenever you rob a criminal like that and you take their drugs?
What's that?
It's called hitting a lick.
Hitting a lick? Really?
Yeah.
I've heard of that, but I thought that was manual labor.
No, hitting a lick means you're, at least on the street, it means you're, if you're hitting licks, it means you're robbing drug dealers.
Huh, I never knew that.
Yeah.
So. Well, the cops were doing that. They were robbing drug dealers.
The cops were hitting licks.
Yeah.
Now, there was one really famous drug deal that took place in 1989 that I want to talk about. But before we get to that, I think we actually have a motion before the court today.
Why, yes, if it pleases your lordship, we'd like to approach the bench to pay for court costs.
All right. Who's in the docket?
We have back with us our good friends at Care Of.
Care Of is a wellness brand that makes it easy to maintain your health goals with customized vitamin plan that helps you feel your best today and supports you long term.
At Care Of, they have high quality products that meet personalization. All of Care Of's products are formulated with good for you, clean ingredients that are backed by science.
Care Of is super transparent about the research and sourcing behind each one of their products. Your recommendations come in daily individually wrapped packets that are perfect for getting back into a routine.
They are quick and reliable results thanks to Care Of's online quiz. Care Of's in-depth 5-minute online quiz asks you questions about your diet, lifestyle, and health concerns to help address your specific wellness goals.
It's time to celebrate the little victories. February can still be your fresh start to the new year, and your resolutions don't have to be big. Small, impactful changes are just as important, like adding a daily vitamin to help support your energy, sleep, or fitness to target those goals, whether in the short or long term.
Make taking better care of your health a priority and make it super easy with Care Of.
And it is super easy. You just jump online, you take the little quiz, you answer some questions, and then Care Of will make a recommendation about what you should take, and it'll ship it straight to your door.
That's right. You and I have both done that. And, I mean, even I passed the quiz because they sent me some vitamins. So I must have done okay.
You can't lose.
It had my name on it and everything, so I knew they were for me.
That's right. And so we have a special offer for court-appointed listeners. You can get 50% off your first Care Of order. Just go to takecareof.com and enter the code COURT50.
That's right. 50% off your first order of Care Of. Just go to takecareof.com and enter the code COURT50. Mike and Tommy want you to get your healthy vitamins today.
So there was one drug deal that really struck me that took place, and it might not be very well known. I didn't know anything about it until I watched this documentary. I did a bit more research about it.
Yeah.
So on September 5th, 1989, George H.W. Bush held up a bag of crack cocaine on live TV, drugs that were purchased, as he told viewers, just steps from the White House where he sat right there. So he had wanted to ramp up the war on drugs even more, so his speechwriters had an idea of photographing a drug sale in front of the White House. The only problem was that there weren't many drug deals that took place there because there was a large police presence and it just didn't really happen. So they recruited a DEA agent, and he was told that he was to arrange a drug deal that was supposed to take place in Lafayette Park right across from the White House. So he called up a dealer that he was working with and said, "Meet me at the White House." They had picked this guy, this 18-year-old high school senior, Keith Jackson, and he had actually never even been to the neighborhood. And he said, "Where the expletive is the White House?" He was from Baltimore. He was from Baltimore.
You need to give me some directions. I don't know where to go.
And they actually recorded this conversation as part of his prosecution. He didn't even know where it was. So undercover agents had been talking to him, and he was a small-time dealer, and they really wanted him to flip on a bigger one. And after trying to convince him, he agreed to meet an agent across from the White House. So sure enough, he sold the drugs to the undercover agent. And then those are the same drugs, the same very bag that were held up on TV by the president. The actual DEA officer who did that actually said he about fell out of his chair when he saw that same bag being held up. He had no idea why that was going on, but you know, he couldn't believe that that was actually the same bag. You know, so,
yeah.
So he was convicted, of course, this 18-year-old kid. He had no prior criminal record, and he was collapsed in tears in the courtroom, and he was sentenced to 10 years in prison for this first offense. And the judge was very reluctant when sentencing him and said that he was going to be sentenced to that because that was part of the new minimum sentencing guidelines, which were passed. And he said during the sentencing, "Bush used you in the sense of making that big drug speech," he told him. And he said, "But he's a decent man, a man of great compassion. Maybe he can find a way to reduce at least some of that sentence." But Bush never did. When he was asked about it, he said, "The man went there and sold drugs in front of the White House, didn't he? ? I can't feel sorry for this fellow."
Yeah.
And he was actually released from prison in 1998. So he served pretty much 10 years just for selling drugs in the White House that he was asked to come sell and set up to do.
Yeah.
And it was all just a big publicity stunt. And, you know, of course, that was a big moment for George H.W. Bush. He was just like, they sold this right in front of the White House.
Well, one of the things that they made clear was that this was a political situation, too, that the Reagan administration, they wanted to appear tough on drugs. So they came up with the first crime bill, that the Drug Abuse Act. So then George Bush, following him, he had to be even tougher. So this was part of his process. And then Bill Clinton coming along behind him, even though he's a Democrat, to get elected, you know, he was running against an incumbent president. Yeah. And so to get elected, he had to be even tougher. So he upped the ante even more when he got in there.
Now, getting back to Jackson when he sold the drugs. So you might think that sounds a bit like entrapment. right?
Well, no, because he was still, he was selling drugs. He just wasn't selling them there normally.
Well, I think in the common definition of entrapment, I think it might meet that. But if you're talking about the legal definition of it, I don't think it definitely doesn't, because entrapment occurs when a person commits a crime that they would not have committed without the presence and influence of law enforcement. Entrapment has to have some degree of persuasion or coercion. If a person would have committed the crime regardless of the actions of law enforcement, entrapment will likely not work as a defense. So if you look at that, would he have come there and sold drugs in front of the White House?
No, no. He might have sold them on his corner in Baltimore, but he wouldn't have sold them there.
Yeah. And so you can kind of differentiate entrapment from sting operations, where a mere opportunity to commit a crime is presented, or a crime that was already committed was reported to the police by a confidential informant. And there has to be some evidence to show that the individual was persuaded to commit a crime that they would not have otherwise committed. So I think you can make a good faith argument it was entrapment, but I don't think it actually wins, unfortunately, for Mr. Jackson. So
yeah.
You know, if the police present an opportunity for a defendant to commit a crime and the prosecution cannot prove the defendant had any propensity or predisposition to do so, then they have to be found not guilty. So the problem is he had a propensity to sell drugs and a predisposition to do so. So the fact that it took place in front of the White House was just rotten luck for that guy.
Boy, I'll say.
He was pretty much used as a pawn.
Yes, very much so.
So start talking about the timeline. In 1988, Congress enacts 5-year mandatory minimum for first time simple possession of 5 grams of crack cocaine.
And 5 grams of crack, the way they explained it in the show, if you break it down, is, you know, those little sugar packs that they give you at the restaurants?
Yep.
That you have sitting there? 5 of those is 5 grams. And that will get you, if it's crack, that will get you a 5 to 40 year sentence.
There is no other first-time simple possession drug offense that requires prison time or a mandatory minimum sentence. Only crack.
Only crack. And in comparison, it would take you 500 grams of cocaine, which is what crack is a derivative of, to get the same sentence.
Yeah, that's a 100-to-1 disparity there.
Yeah.
Now, in 1994, Bill Clinton, he signed the Violent Crime Control Bill, and this had tens of millions going into expand the prison system, and incarcerations took off. From 1985 to 1995, there was a 707% increase in black prisoners for drug offenses. 707% in a 10-year period.
On top of that, it was mostly the crack law that they were being arrested under. And even though it was proven 2/3 of the crack users were white, of the people that were prosecuted under the crack law, every single one of them was black.
Yeah, it's just crazy. Now, the Sentencing Commission in 1995, they issued their first research report to Congress on crack cocaine, finding that because over 80% of crack offenders are black, and because the 100-to-1 ratio results in unduly high sentences, sentences are harsher for minorities and create a public perception that the criminal justice system is unfair and inconsistent. And so the Sentencing Commission in 1995 tries to amend the guidelines to equalize the amount of crack and powder cocaine that trigger particular sentences, and Congress rejects the amendment. Again, part of the whole perception, mm-hmm. I got to be tough on crime. You know,
right.
I'm a politician. I got to protect my seat. I got to be tough on crime. I can't do it.
And then what do we see in these pardons that we just talked about?
Yeah.
People that were being pardoned because they were sentenced to life for these drug offenses, and some of them were these crack cocaine, I'm sure, and some of them were marijuana, but they were under the 3-strike laws. But yeah, They're all mandatory sentencing that's really not mixed with any common sense.
Well, the crack cocaine actually kind of took care of itself here as we unfold. But yeah, the ones, most of those pardons we saw were for marijuana. So in 1997, the commission issues a second report to Congress offering a range of options for revising the 100-to-1 disparity, not adopted. 2002, the Sentencing Commission issues a third report, which debunks the flawed misconceptions about the effect of crack cocaine on its users and recommending Congress increase crack cocaine quantities to 25 grams for the five-year mandatory and 250 grams for the 10-year mandatory. So they're trying to say, you need to change these percentages. There's a problem here. This mm-hmm. is the third time the Sentencing Commission did that between 1995 and 2002, but Congress didn't really do anything. Congress refused to do it. The commission asked them to, and they did these actually with written reports, that current crack penalties exaggerate the harmfulness of crack, which is pharmacologically identical to powder cocaine. The negative effects of prenatal exposure to crack are identical to those of prenatal exposure to powder cocaine. Current crack penalties overpunish low-level crack offenders and apply too many low-level crack offenders and street-level dealers rather than major traffickers. When you know that small amount, I mean, that's it wouldn't be uncommon for somebody to go to a larger dealer, buy a little bit more, and give some to a friend. But if you happen to arrest that person in the interim, they have more than that, then they're up for that larger sentencing guideline.
Right.
The report also said the amount of violence associated with crack was overstated. The current sentences unfairly punish all crack offenders as if they used violence or weapons, even though they didn't. And the 101 disparity results in overly harsh sentences for crack offenders and produces racial disparity in sentencing. 80% of those convicted crack offenders are black. I mean,
yeah.
The commission is just basically imploring Congress, please change these.
Well,
they won't do it.
If you wonder what systemic racism is, that's a prime example of it right there. That's systemic racism. It was mostly affecting the black population, and all the old white men that ran the country didn't care. They weren't that worried about it affecting them because they didn't value them to the same level.
And the U.S. Supreme Court finally got involved in the United States versus Booker, and they ruled that the federal sentencing guidelines are advisory and no longer mandatory. So basically the Supreme Court finally got fed up with it and said, no, we're throwing these out. Don't you want to follow them.
Good.
2007, the commission issues a fourth report to Congress calling for new legislation, increasing the quantities of crack cocaine that trigger the 5 and 10 year mandatory sentences, decreasing the 101 drug ratio and repealing the 5 year mandatory sentence for simple possession. And nothing happens. November 1st, 2007, the USSC amendment to the sentencing guideline reduces crack sentences issued under the guidelines by an average of 15 months. And then in 2007, the U.S. Supreme Court again weighs in Kimbrough v. United States and says that a sentencing judge may depart from the federal sentencing guideline sentence for crack cocaine if the court disagrees with the disparity between crack and powder cocaine sentences contained in the guidelines. So again, the Supreme Court is reiterating, don't follow them, not just for the sentencing guidelines, but hey, here's a specific. We're really going to point this out for you. Look at these crack cocaine sentencing guidelines because it's up to you. So now eventually there's an amendment to it and they reduce the sentences an average of 26 months and approximately 16,500 crack offenders in federal prisons are affected by this in March of 2008. Finally, in 2010, the Senate passes the Fair Sentencing Act of 2010, which creates an 18-to-1 ratio between crack and powder cocaine. And under that bill, 28 grams of crack and 500 grams of powder cocaine trigger the 5-year mandatory minimum. And it's basically the first time since the Nixon administration that a mandatory minimum had been repealed. And it was signed into law in August 3rd of 2003 by President Obama. It instructs the Sentencing Commission to amend the crack cocaine guidelines to reflect the new law of the 18-to-1 powder ratio. So if you think about that, 2010 is when this actually is signed into law, changing it. But since, what is that, 1986?
Mm-hmm.
So from 1986 to 2010, all these people, all these minorities, essentially, were sentenced harsher because of crack cocaine.
Right.
And they applied retroactively, so anybody who was charged with these sentencing guidelines had a chance to get it fixed, essentially. But, you know, for what good? They had already served all this time.
There is one point in there where they had even gone so far as to take pregnant women that were addicted to crack and would charge them with giving their babies that were still in them, giving them drugs. They would charge them with like the same as if you did shot a child up with drugs or something like that.
Yeah, the theory that they had, it was the one thing that kind of jumped out at my attention, is that the prosecuting attorney charged them with giving their child cocaine through the umbilical cord.
Right.
Just like basically seconds after they were born. So that was when it took place. Now, it's not uncommon when a child is born, if they're born drug affected, to send off the umbilical cord to see if there are any traces of drugs or whatnot in the umbilical cord, because they do stay there.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that there's actually any kind of medical science that shows that the child is delivered the drugs after they are born through the umbilical cord. By then it's already done.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, their whole theory was that the baby is actually alive at that point when it's born.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when you're doing it.
Right.
So they weren't charging them while the baby was still in utero, because they couldn't. So they were trying to be creative and say, well, since it's in the umbilical cord and since it's actually a person now, then obviously that you were giving them drugs then.
But the biggest problem was, obviously, these women had a drug problem they couldn't fix. So you're not doing anything to help these poor people with their lives and get their lives back on track. All you're doing is demonizing them. And that's what they did. And that was one of the things that this crack epidemic did to all the black communities, is it devastated the black families, because the women were the centerpiece. They were the thing that held all the families together. And when they started going down and you started demonizing them and criminalizing this to the point where they were taking them out en masse, the one lady talked about 70 of them being chained up together and taken in. And she said, I really wondered how far we had come from our ancestors that were brought over here on a boat.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of what it was. It was modern day slavery through incarceration.
Yeah, it was a super, super interesting documentary and super sad, but very enlightening about a lot of things.
Yeah, it sure was. Said that the war on drug has cost the United States nearly $1 trillion, and the prison population has exploded from around 300,000 in 1980 to 2 million today.
Yeah, the number is just staggering. Now, one interesting thing we were talking about before we started the episode is that President Biden signed an executive order to phase out private prisons on Tuesday of last week. And it's part of the administration's action and effort to try to address racial inequity in the country. So they're trying, this is kind of the first step, supposedly, of trying to phase out these private prisons where more people are incarcerated. But a lot of people are kind of critical of it and saying it's a good step, but it's not enough.
Right. We need to get rid of the ones that we have. It's a proven fact that these prisons, these private prisons, they make their money by being at full occupancy. So yeah, they've got no motivation to ever rehabilitate anybody or get them out. They want more people in.
Yeah, private prisons are a $1 billion industry now. In 2019, 8.1% of people incarcerated in the U.S. were held in private prisons, according to the most recent data from the Bureau of Justice Statistics. And that doesn't even apply to contracts with agencies like ICE and other things like that, these other holding facilities. Mm-hmm. That's just the ones that are in the prisons. So 8.1% are in private. So I do not like the privatization of prisons. I don't think it's a good thing. And I think it's good that President Biden signed this. But it's not saying that you need to shut all these private prisons down. It's just saying you're not supposed to renew the contracts with them.
Right.
So it's a step towards phasing it out. But again, if you're really...
Private juvenile detention centers are the same. Those need to go too.
Yeah, absolutely. But if you're really looking at the effort by the administration, I think it does fall kind of short of what they're trying to do here. If they're really trying to address some of the racial inequity in our country as far as with the prison systems.
Well, I hope the next step is that they decriminalize marijuana for several reasons. One is that it's at odds with the states that have legalized it. And actually any bank that's an FDIC bank is operating out there on a limb all by themselves, because the federal, that's a, you know, marijuana stores that use them as their bank are actually working against the federal government. The federal government could come in and close them down.
Yeah, it's a mess. They need to address that immediately, but who knows if they will or not.
And then the other thing is you could decrease part of your overpopulation of the prisons by, if you decriminalized it and let everybody out that was a nonviolent marijuana-only offender.
Yeah, similar to what the pardons were by Trump just mm-hmm. recently.
Yeah.
Yeah, for, like we said, for all the things that we disagree with, I mean, those were probably good pardons for a lot of those people. So.
Yeah. I couldn't get mad about that.
You're like, And daggone it, I really tried. I really wanted to.
I wanted to look at the list and see all these Republican cronies that were all in cahoots and all this. And hell, the biggest part of them were people that really probably shouldn't have been there for that long anyway.
What do you mean he's pardoning Gordon Gekko? Oh my gosh, this is horrible.
You want a friend, get a dog.
Well, I think that's going to bring us to
Legal briefs.
So legal briefs is the part of the show where I ask Tommy different legal questions. And I got a couple here that he probably should have seen coming because they were explained a bit more.
Uh-oh.
What is entrapment?
Entrapment, that's when you entice someone to do something, to break the law in a manner in which they ordinarily wouldn't have done it unless you set up the circumstances for them to do it.
That's it. That's true. And the words that I like to remember, because it's got a nice alliteration to it, if the defendant had any propensity or predisposition to do so, then they have to be found not guilty.
All right. So, propensity or predisposition or possession.
Or possession. So we're going to switch it up from a legal question to a chemistry question. Chemically, what is the difference between crack and cocaine?
Well, in crack, you cook the salt off the cocaine. So
yeah.
So that the salt is gone. Once it's gone, then it hardens back up after you cook it into a nice little rock, and you can put that in your pipe and smoke it, and it goes straight to your brain for an immediate high.
Where does the salt go?
Well, I guess it evaporates or something.
I don't know. I don't know either. That was just a general question.
It goes in the ocean. That's why it's so salty.
The ocean actually wasn't salty until the crack epidemic.
Yeah, that's right. It was fresh water.
And so how do you make crack?
How do you make it? You have to cook it. You cook the cocaine and it makes the crack rocks.
But what's the science behind it? In crack lab, how do you make crack? And if you were in a lab making crack, how would you do it?
I'm not sure. And if I did know, I don't think I'd want to espouse having that much knowledge.
Well, I already said it. I read it from that. So basically what the person does is they take it and they combine it with baking soda.
Oh, yeah.
Back up to my notes here.
I remember you saying that.
And they combine it with water and usually baking soda, and they boil it and then solids form. So when they do that, the baking soda, the sodium bicarbonate, cooks off the salt, and then it forms those rocks, which are broken into smaller little crack rocks.
Right.
And do you know why it is called crack?
Because of the crackling noise that it makes when you cook it.
That's right. And the final softball. What's Nancy Reagan's favorite saying?
Just say no to drugs.
That's right.
The one of those commercials that got me was the one with Pee Wee Herman on it. And he goes, if you do drugs, you might be right, dead right, or something like that. Or you might be wrong, dead wrong. Probably was more like it.
Yeah.
But Pee Wee Herman on there, who could take him serious?
I don't know. I went to a movie theater one time with Pee Wee Herman. We saw a movie together.
Oh, I know what he does in movies. Is that what kind of movie you were at?
No, that was a joke.
Oh. You ever see him on Blacklist? Remember that TV show Blacklist?
No, I've kind of watched a few episodes of it. I haven't really watched too many of them, though.
He played a character on there that would appear intermittently. And first time I saw him, like, I know that guy. Who is that guy? That's Pee Wee Herman. But, of course, he's not playing Pee Wee Herman. He's Paul Reubens playing a different character. But it's still funny to see Pee Wee Herman on the Blacklist.
Yeah. Yeah. He's the loner, Dottie. The rebel.
Yeah. Tequila. Nobody hit me to that, dudes.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Dr. Lawyer Indian Chief.
We're proud to be coming to you almost live from Smurl Studios, high atop Three Last Mountain.
And we want to thank Audio Boom for being a part of their network.
And we also want to thank the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for helping give us our start. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, Still Buffering, and many other fine offerings.
If you have the chance, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you like us. And if you didn't, don't bother.
You're not supposed to say that.
You're going to edit that out, though, aren't you?
Why? You never did.
Thanks for listening. This has been Court Appointed. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude. Hello, welcome to Tommy's Random Thought. Today's random thought is Charlie Thompson. When I get ready to do my random thoughts, it is usually about whatever is most present in my mind at the time. Things that I am thinking, why or what if or how come. Then I just sort of go from there and basically have a conversation with myself and try to fully flesh out the thought. Often, I change what the thought is because by the time I get to the end, I realize that the core of the subject was different from the symptomatic word that was originally in my head. For example, last week's division thought was originally challenges. As I concluded it, however, I felt the final outcome was more about division than it was about challenges, so I changed it. Anyway, I say all that because my random thought has never been a person, so I know that seems kind of strange. Not only that, there are only maybe 4 or 5 people that even listen to this podcast that will know who Charlie Thompson is. Or sadly, was. I made the comment in a random thought a couple weeks back that all of these people so resistant to wearing masks or saying that COVID is a hoax must not have lost anyone close to them as a result of this deadly virus. I had not, but I still did believe and want everyone I know or am related to take all necessary precautions. While I am lucky that I haven't lost an actual family member, like my 87-year-old dad that I helped to get vaccinated, I did just lose someone that was part of my theater family, Charlie Thompson. If you have ever been involved in theater, then you know what I mean by theater family. You spend so much time together rehearsing and building and creating and helping each other be vulnerable in order to bring out their best, that you almost go into a depression when the show is over, because you have all worked so hard together, and all the people that watch, and even your own family members, don't know what you went through and how it all works, so you really cling to each other. You try to maintain those relationships after it's over, but people go their different ways. Some become new friends, but there are always new shows and new family to meet. One thing I've learned is, you can never go back. Just like that line in Don Henley's Boys of Summer. One of the first big shows I ever performed in was My Fair Lady at our outdoor amphitheater, where we would get about 1,000 people per performance. I played Professor Henry Higgins, and his sidekick, Pickering, was played by Charlie Thompson. I didn't know Charlie prior to that show, but the best way I could describe him was that he was a gentle, sweet man with a beautiful baritone voice. When he sang, you didn't just hear it, you felt it. Me, I am not a singer. Fortunately, I could get by speak singing, just like Rex Harrison, who played the part in the movie, did. Charlie and I spent a lot of the show together, as we were in a lot of the same scenes. He helped me a lot because this was only my second show. I could not have asked for a better person to work with. Charlie had a wonderful sense of comedic timing as well, and as my character was basically the straight man, setting up some great one-liners for his Pickering. I only did one other show with Charlie after that, when he was Richard Lee of Virginia and I was John Hancock in 1776. Again, his comedic timing and velvet voice stole the show, as he made so much out of a relatively minor role in this ensemble cast. But as always, he was one of the most gracious castmates that I've ever worked with. He was still Pickering, however, to me. I always called him that, and when I would see him out somewhere, I would bellow out, "Pickering!" as Higgins did in the show quite often. Charlie Thompson died of COVID last week. COVID is real. It does kill. Don't fool yourself. While I hadn't seen Charlie in a couple of years, I still find the world to feel a little colder without him in it. I am sorry that no one will get to hear his booming velvet voice, or see his perfectly placed lines on stage, or see Charlie the sweet gentleman that he was. Likewise, I will never again bellow, "Pickering!" because our sweet Pickering is no longer with us. COVID is real. This has been Tommy's Random Thought.